Has your research taken you far and wide? Have you traveled to meet these people, or do you just, how do you conduct your interviews and
So, I mean, I like I said, I like to mostly, well, a lot of my subjects are dead. So
what? Hey, I'm out of here.
that so that is unfortunate.
Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum
and Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
To his brute embrace.
Godzilla has a brain about this size. He is sheer brute force. While Kong is a thinking animal, his brain is considerably larger, about 10 times the size of this gorilla's skull. Being instinctive rivals, there is no doubt that they will attempt to destroy one another.
King Kong versus Godzilla, heading for their colossal collision. Shattering every obstacle that stands between them in the most fantastic rampage of annihilation ever recorded on film. See King Kong stamp Tokyo into the ground, holding a beautiful girl in his grasp. See Godzilla destroy an entire army. See King Kong trapped by the blazing barrier of 1 billion volts. But nothing, nobody can stop the great showdown. When King Kong and Godzilla meet to fight for survival of the fittest.
And Matt, we have a strange beast with us tonight, waiting in the wings. Tom Shabilla, he's an author, he's a writer, he's written a new book. We love having guests on the show who are here to talk about their own art and works in the monster movie genre. I'm thinking about Sean Pryor, for one, who came on and talked about his book Kaiju Unleashed. So we're pretty excited.
Indeed, yeah, it's always fun. We had Steffi on for a recent episode, Steffi Theodora, to talk about The Abominable Snowman. So yeah, we always love having guest stars on here.
Special thanks to our Patreon members. You know who you are, but I'm going to say your names because that's what you're owed. And that goes out to Jason, Chris, Sean, Peggy, Superfan Don, the aforementioned Steffi Theodora, and our anonymous patron. Thank you for your support. We hope you like what we got.
Indeed. Thank you. And I was just going to mention, Sean Pryor is coming back on the show. We're going to be talking about, well, you're bringing this movie to the podcast. You can talk about this if you want to.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Look at us. We're mind melding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Blackula, 1972, blaxploitation film. Honestly, I only know it by reputation, which maybe the reputation I've heard is like something to be made fun of. It's Blackula. It's the Black Dracula. But after hearing from a lot of noted historians and all this I'll get into on our episode, but including Sean Pryor himself, who he chose to bring this movie to the podcast because he says there's a lot to get from this movie. And I'm really eager to dig into that legacy and maybe give that movie its just desserts.
Yeah, I've heard mostly good things about it. I know the title is a little bit ridiculous, but I've wanted to see it for a long time. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of my favorite sort of intersections between like horror movies and kind of a unique cultural perspective on like horror movie lore. So I'm surprised that it's taken me so long to actually watch it.
I know. And they're same here. I've never seen it. There's a sequel, Scream, Blackula, Scream. I mean, there are a dozen imitators out there. Blackenstein, is that right?
Yeah, that sounds right. I've never seen that movie either.
Yeah. But there are some, so the when I talk about film historians, I'm talking about this documentary I've mentioned on the series before called Horror Noir. It's a Shudder original, would highly recommend. There's a lot, it's just a really insightful documentary about horror films and the history of horror through the Black African-American experience, earlier films on newer films and the filmmakers behind them. And it's just a really rich discussion when you're getting people of different perspectives at the table.
Totally. Yeah. I've seen some episodes of that show because it's like an ongoing series, right?
It might have been released in episodic,
okay,
in an episodic format. Yeah.
Gotcha. I haven't seen the whole thing, but it is a really good show. I did want to shout out another movie called Ganja and Hess, which is another kind of vampire movie from an African-American perspective. That's a really great movie. That's actually playing at the Heights Theater later this month, Friday, February 20th. So I wanted to shout that out. It's one of a kind, directed by Bill Gunn. I think it's totally different from Blackula, as far as I understand. I've never seen Blackula, but Ganja and Hess is great. Highly recommend that one.
That's fantastic. I've never seen it either, but what I have or what I know of it, my impression is more of a somber piece of filmmaking, which we love on this show as much as the campy stuff.
Totally, yeah. Maybe closer to The Addiction than Blackula. We had recently talked about that movie.
Right, right. Matt, you know what movie I just recently saw?
Hmm.
It's have you heard of Belle, Book, and Candle?
Yeah, I've seen that movie.
You've seen it?
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just watched it last night. Yeah. Well, what I wrote on Letterboxd was a whimsical performance from James Stewart. Elsa Lanchester. Mm-hmm. I loved that. Was a wonderful surprise. Jack Lemmon. But I think Kim Novak just steals the show. Her presence is electric in that movie. Fantastic. And you know what I was truly impressed with? The cinematography.
Yep.
Do you know who did that?
You know, I don't. I don't remember.
James Wong Howe.
Wow. We've talked about him on the show before, right?
We have. I can't remember with what. Because he's done like 100 movies. He's very prolific.
Yeah. Yeah, he's an amazing cinematographer and like just a very interesting life story, I think. You know, he shot a lot of movies in like the classical Hollywood era. And I think maybe the assumption is that, you know, he's Chinese ethnically, his family is Chinese. And like, so he was Chinese American. And I just feel like the assumption is like, there were not too many cinematographers who were, you know, not white at that period of classical Hollywood filmmaking. And he, you know, it's not true. And he's one good example of that.
So fantastic. We'll talk more about Belle, Book, and Candle later, I'm sure.
Hasn't this cat got anything better to do? Couldn't you give him something to read?
I'm more in love with you than I've ever been with anyone.
I'm Sidney Redditch. You don't know me, but I think I want to see you.
Good evening, Nicholas.
Evening, gentlemen.
You startled me.
Ring the bell, close the book, quench the candle.
I'm one.
You're one what?
One of the people that the book's about, and Nikki's one too.
The only perversions that can be comfortably condemned are the perversions of others. will persist and survive without God's or society's sanction. I will not be tortured. I will not be punished. I will not be guilty. The blood of our Lord Jesus Christ, which was shed for thee, preserve thee body and soul for everlasting life. Drink this in remembrance that Christ's blood was shed for thee. And be thankful.
He's a victim.
Dr. Stein would like to see you in his laboratory.
Brings you to California?
Well, I just arrived from New York. My fiance was wounded in Vietnam, and the doctors there wrote and told me he was being transferred to the Veterans Hospital here. He was seriously wounded when a landmine went off under him.
Eddie, this is Dr. Stein, the doctor I studied with when I was in school.
Now, tell me once again, Eddie, what do you feel?
That was my middle finger.
That's correct.
Stein, look at this.
Blackenstein! Yeah, welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
You know, the great thing about our setup is that it's not live. We're not recording live.
I'm a professor at a community college, and I have a late night class on Tuesday that I occasionally teach, so, yeah.
Well, we thank you for making the time.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I just like talking about this stuff. So
us too.
And Tom has written a book called King Kong versus Godzilla, the most colossal conflict the screen has ever known.
Yes, it's a work of love, to be perfectly honest with you. And I've two books prior to this. One was called Primetime 1966-67. It was about the first season of color television, or entirely color television, I should say. And then the second one was called James Bond and the 60s Spy Craze, and dealt with the James Bond movies and knockoffs and spoofs and exploitation of the era. But my first love of everything is monsters. I'm a monster kid. I've always loved monster movies, and I've been involved with that. I've written for Scream Magazine, Monster Bash Magazine, and when I take it to conventions like Monster Bash Convention, things like that, people would say, "Well, where's the book about monsters? Like this is what we want. Like, and this is what we expect from you." And so I was like, I don't know what to write about. Like, I felt like everything that I love has been written about to death. You know, I love Godzilla. I love King Kong. I love, you know, Dracula, Frankenstein, Wolfman. I love my classic monsters, but everything's kind of been done to death. And I wanted to focus on a singular subject. And so I was kind of like looking through stuff, and I started writing about, my original idea actually was a monster rally films. So films with multiple monsters. So I started with the Universal. I started writing about those. I got on to, you know, a couple later things. And I started writing about King Kong versus Godzilla. And I'm like, oh man, this is an awesome subject. This is such a cool movie. It's such a fun movie. I love both these monsters. And then I said, has there been a book written about this movie? And there hasn't. And I'm like, jackpot. So I scrapped everything that I had at that point, and I went gung-ho into this film. And yeah, so here I am with it. So it was a lot of research, and like I said, it was a real labor of love, I guess you could say.
That's such a real journey as a writer. I mean, yeah. Matt and I are both writers, and you know, you're like, okay, it's been done to death, but like, where's the angle I can get in and like add a fresh perspective? And there's always opportunity for that.
Sure.
And King Kong versus Godzilla, the production backstory is so interesting and rich. And
yeah.
And Honda's involvement and how he, you know, his hesitation with the material, and he himself, Honda, is thinking, what fresh perspective can I even lend to this, this genre monster movie that, I mean, he at this point in Honda's output with Toho, right? He was feeling a little, I don't know, how would you describe it? His approach to the rubber suit monster genre.
From what I've kind of gathered, it was he definitely had an interest in the subject. I think he probably was a little hesitant to bring a little bit more of a fun, like fun factor, a child, like something yeah. that would maybe appeal to children. I did in the book, I did an interview with Linda Miller, who was in King Kong Escapes, and she wasn't in King Kong versus Godzilla. Unfortunately, I couldn't find anybody from King Kong versus Godzilla who's alive or and or willing to talk to me and doesn't have a, you know, a language barrier here. So I thought, well, okay, she's the next best thing. Linda Miller is super nice. She lives in Virginia. She speaks English, and she wants to talk about her experiences because she was kind of out of it for not out of it, but she had no idea that anybody cared about this kind of stuff. She had no idea that there was a podcast like this that was talking and that was obsessing over her movies, her movie, I should say. She was in one movie, and she was in The Green Slime, but she was an extra. But I asked her about that. I asked her about Ishiro Honda, and I asked her about, like, you know, what sense did you get out of him? Did you get a sense that he really loved this stuff, or did you get a sense like he was a company man salary man, I guess, and really liked making this stuff? And her, you know, kind of experience was like he really liked, you know, yeah, he was probably given marching orders from Toho. Yeah, he probably, you know, didn't have a whole lot of say in what he was going to do, but he did love the genre. So clearly he took it in a way that he took what he loved. He did what he loved. And that was making these movies. And he and Tubaraya both loved King Kong. So I think that this was their chance to make that monster that influenced them to begin with.
That's such a great point. Like that I guess I hadn't thought about before, the fact that like we take King Kong for granted, but in 1962, this was the first Kong film in 30 years.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. And now these guys who they themselves, you could say, were monster kids, Tsuburaya and Honda, they loved King Kong, and here they are getting a chance, getting a crack at it.
Yeah. Then they were definitely part of that, you know, first wave, first generation of monster kids. Of people that discovered this stuff before Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, before the Shock Package, where you could say definitely guys like, you know, Ed Wood in America, even, you know, where he was, you know, trying to create these classic horror movies, you know, poorly in America, but they all were part of that generation.
Yeah.
That saw these movies originally and were inspired, and there was a bit of a lull in the, you know, late 30s of new people doing it, and even in the 40s.
I think of someone like Ray Harryhausen and Ray Bradbury, you know, they grew up, they're very outspoken in their interviews. Yeah, I saw King Kong when I was a kid in 1933, and now I want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and yeah, definitely King Kong. Yeah, King Kong did start it all. And King Kong, that certainly inspired people. One thing that one theory that I have in the book is that King Kong in 1956 played on WOR New York television for a week straight. So twice a day, three times on the weekend. Which is incredible. And at a time when you had four television stations, maybe there was like six in New York, which is incredible, which is, yeah. is you know, just monumental. It apparently got monster ratings, no pun intended. And there it is. You know, people still care about this movie that at that point was 33 years old. So that really kicked off, again, kind of this television craze of monster movies. And yeah, and then King Kong definitely always kicks this off. King Kong was always the catalyst of things. You know, from there we had movies like, you know, again, in the meantime, Godzilla eventually, you know, coming out later in that decade. So we had, you know, Godzilla and yeah, everything else. So
everything else. Godzilla and Kong, baby.
Yeah.
Tom, you talk about this a little bit in the book, but I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about like how you first got into monster movies when you were a kid. You write about
absolutely
watching old VHS tapes and everything.
So it all started. Yeah, my parents. I have a story in the book that apparently the day before I was born, it's the family story. The day before I was born, my mom watched a tape of the incredibly strange creatures that stopped living to become mixed up zombies. I never had a chance in life, straight up.
Doomed from the start.
Yeah, I was doomed. And yeah, my dad kind of just obsessively recorded a lot of these things from Philadelphia television that were airing really cool movies at the time. King Kong was definitely on those tapes. I still have them, and I could go back to them occasionally, but. Yeah, they had a ton of really cool movies. And also, during that time, it was when Godzilla 85 came out. And they had the Dr. Pepper commercials with Godzilla. So my first run-ins with Godzilla were these Dr. Pepper commercials, you know, where I didn't quite know... You know, I feel like you had to have known who he is. Like maybe just instinctually, I knew who Godzilla was. I wasn't quite sure. And so watching, you know, just getting bad monster movies, bad horror movies, just constantly. And I never saw a difference. Like I would have friends over my house, and I'd say, "Oh, let's watch a movie," and I'd pop in like, you know, Robot Monster or something. And you're like, what are we watching? Why are we watching a black and white movie? Like, I don't understand this. And I don't know. I like it. So, you know, that's always been my run-ins with these movies. And yeah, I talk about that. I talk about the finding the Crestwood House books in my school library. I could still, if I walked into what was then the... Holy Name of Jesus School, I could still tell you where those monster books were. God knows why they were there, but they were there in that life.
If they're still there.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's great. Matt and I talk about this all the time. Similar experiences. I grew up in the 90s when there was still that pre-internet subculture to monster movies. I mean, I'm going to show you my own tapes right now. So. Off of AMC, I would record The Invisible Man, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. I made my own little cover art.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that.
And then years ago, I got these digitized, the tapes. So I have them on my hard drive now with all the old commercials and the static snow, because the tapes are going on 30 years old now. But they're pride, they're little joys of... pride for me there. But then my mom, she grew up, I mean, she had like one old VHS copy of Godzilla versus Megalon. And I wore that thing out growing up. And then at my local video store, there were like the same four or five Godzilla movies that I would continuously rent out. And I actually forgot to return Godzilla versus the Smog Monster when I was a kid. So I still have that in like the video store cassette tape.
Good thing they probably went out of business because, you know, a really big fine.
Most definitely.
my video store, yeah, I would consistently rent, you know, Godzilla movies and things like that, because they had a thing. It was like older movies, which, you know, again, I had no interest in watching a newer movie, but it was like three movies, three nights, $3. So perfect. You know, there's that was your weekend right there.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
I love how the book kind of, you know, you were just talking about like the rise of television and how that introduced so many people, especially young people, to these older monster movies. And then, you know, the scope of the book is really vast. It talks about the Heisei era of Godzilla all the way up through like the more recent, you know, legendary pictures like monster rallies, as you were talking about. So I think it's cool that you use King Kong versus Godzilla to like chart the history of like monster movie fanship, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And quite frankly, then it's a sin that it took them this long to make another King Kong versus Godzilla.
Yeah.
You know, it sells itself. It's a movie that inherently you knew about. For whatever reason, you knew about this movie. People talked about this movie. You know, I certainly remember, like you were saying, the kind of those early, not necessarily pre-internet days, but early internet days. Like, I definitely remember people talking about the possibility of a sequel being made or you know, something along those lines in the Heisei era. That was always brought up. And you know, so yeah, I definitely tried to chart that course of monster movies, especially kaiju films, using that as the backdrop. How this inspired those films, why, you know, Kong being left out of certain films is, again, just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, and probably would have made things a little bit better on occasion.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, just like as a fan, when you watch some of the Showa era movies like Destroy All Monsters, where it's this huge monster rally?
Yeah.
No Kong. Or the fact that Kong, Toho's Kong, only got two pictures. And I mean, Toho had the rights to the character.
Yeah, 5 years apparently. I've said it before. If I was a film studio, if I was Toho Studios, and you said, by the way, you have King Kong for 5 years. King Kong goes to space. King Kong goes underwater. King Kong versus Mothra. I'd be making it all. I'd be using King Kong every day. I mean, what are you doing? Like, it makes zero sense to me of why you would do that. But, you know, they didn't make... I love both movies. I do love King Kong versus Godzilla. I do love King Kong Escapes. Even though I think that they should have made it a direct sequel.
Hmm.
But
yeah, King Kong Escapes, I'll be honest, I only recently saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I had maybe, of course, I don't know why I had low expectations, but I just kind of did. But I was proven so wrong. That movie, I can't say enough about that movie. In terms of like Honda's direction and his love letter to Kong, it is, mm-hmm. it is a fantastically well made and like really, he takes it really seriously, actually. As silly as Mechani Kong could be, there's a lot of tension and stakes in that movie, too.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of it is, you know, apparently has to do with Rankin Bass, who owned the King Kong show at the time and were doing it. And they wanted it in their direction. And there is a lot of overlap of the King Kong show and that movie, particularly like the name of the family and.
Doctor Who. Yeah.
Who is not Doctor Who, but
no.
Doctor Who. So yeah. I really like that. I really do like that film. And but again, we could have also had Mechanicong versus Mechagodzilla. Just saying.
Because that was Mechanicong is a Toho original, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, well, that's my thing with Toho in general. They only reuse the same five main monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Megalon deserves more appearances. Gigan, you name it. I mean, there are so many characters in the catalog just not being used.
Yeah, even especially, you know, I've in the newer one, it's Godzilla minus Zero is going to be the new one, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a million fan theories in the last 2 months or so of what the monster could be that possibly Godzilla fights.
Yeah. How do you feel? What are your,
you know, I would love to see the Smog Monster. I would love to see that. One of my favorites. The movie's a little goofy, but just the cartoon element of that movie, I think, is really goofy. I'm always confused even just watching that a little bit, but I think he's a truly terrifying monster. You know, he has some really great scenes. I would like to see that. That would be, I think, part of the overall, you know, the message of that film certainly hasn't gone away. If anything, it's gotten worse.
So, yeah, honestly, more needed than ever.
The more need of that than ever. And who to save us than Godzilla than Godzilla. So I would like to see that. That would be cool. But again, I'll take what I can get.
Right. Anytime there's ever going to be a Godzilla movie, I will see it in the theaters. Even whatever, just off the walls, dumb fun that this legendary output has been. I mean, Matt and I saw the latest Godzilla X Kong with a group of people. We don't think it was like a great movie by any means, but we had a lot of fun watching it, right?
Oh, yeah.
You could always have fun watching those films. You could always have fun watching a Godzilla film. So that's the one thing that stayed with them.
I do miss the Suitmation days, though, you know? Like to see all the CGI, it's impressive, but it just doesn't, it's not the same, you know?
Yeah, I think it was, and I may have mentioned it in the book, I don't even remember at this point. I think it was Leonard Maltin. Leonard Maltin said something along the lines of, you know, when it's a man in a suit, you know it's fake, but you know it's real. You know, like, I could go to somewhere and I could touch that suit. Like, I could hold the Godzilla suit and the King Kong suit. I could hold it up. I could touch it. It's tactile. But CGI, it looks real, but you know it's fake.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, it's zeros and ones that could be, you know, manipulated and deleted, you know? So there's just something about it that's cool. Warmth. It's the same reason why probably, you know, I collect records, you know, if I had the means, I would probably, and the patience and the space, I would be running film. Mm-hmm. Right. You know why I like going to a movie theater that shows film. There's now a movie theater about an hour from my house, the Gap Theater in Wind Gap, Pennsylvania, that shows exclusively 35 millimeter prints, and I'm like, I'm there. I'm 2 weeks ago we showed King Kong versus Godzilla, and I was thrilled to death. I was more than happy to sponsor that. I was more than happy to do the intro and sell my books. But, you know, I would have gone whether or not they let me or not.
Yeah. That's fantastic. We saw, Matt and I went to see King Kong, the 33 King Kong, at a local theater in Minneapolis that also just shows old movies on film.
Nice.
And it was 35 millimeter. And it was just, and like, there was an organ player down front. Just to see this movie I've seen 100 times, but never on the big screen with a bunch of people behind me. It was a really great experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Kong's a great, always a great movie to watch on the big screen.
The thrills.
As it was meant to be.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
I've incorporated Kong, even though it was, I don't know if it was before I was born, but I definitely have zero recollection of it. But yeah, I think it ended early 80s. But Kong is my Thanksgiving movie. I watch King Kong every Thanksgiving. Once again, WOR, that originally showed Kong, in the 70s, showed King Kong on Thanksgiving. Then they expanded it to Kong, Son of Kong, and Mighty Joe Young. And then eventually expanded it to Black Friday and expanded it to, you know, those three films. And then Godzilla, King Kong versus Godzilla. And they would make a different Godzilla movie on, different Godzilla movies on Black Friday. So, cool. So yeah, King Kong is my, that's what I want to do on Thanksgiving, you know. Somebody says, you know, what are you doing on Thanksgiving? Is I'm watching King Kong. Like I don't know what else there is.
Totally.
What else do you need? That's it.
Yeah.
It's America's monster.
Yeah.
Goes perfect with Thanksgiving.
Tom, you do talk in the book a little bit about Frankenstein Conquers the World, which is a movie that I like. It's such a bizarre movie. We've talked about that on the podcast before. But, you know, I get the sense, like, King Kong versus Godzilla, you wrote a whole book about it. So obviously that has, like, a special place of love in your heart. Why do you think Frankenstein Conquers the World maybe doesn't have that same appeal, at least for you personally?
It doesn't have the same fun that King Kong versus Godzilla has, even though it actually... The premise of the film is dynamite. Just that first 5 minutes of that film, I can watch all the time. Sometimes I just put on the first 10 minutes of that movie of that Dr. Frankenstein is working for the Nazis. They move the heart. The heart gets moved to Japan. The atomic wow! Like yeah. That's like I could. Who thought of that? That's incredible. So. But then after that, I think it just kind of it goes downhill a little bit. I love the film. I can watch I do watch it a lot, but sometimes I just need that first 10-15 minutes of that movie.
Yeah. How can you live up to that beginning? Yeah.
Yeah, you can't live up to that beginning. And it's not as fun. It's not it's just simply not the same. It's you know, it does have the giant octopus, which I do love. It has probably the original ending of the King Kong versus Godzilla sequel where they get sucked into the ground, things like that. So
case in point, Toho, if you're listening, we need more giant Frankenstein kaiju movies.
Yeah.
The Gargantua's back. These are prime characters just sitting on the shelf too long.
I completely agree. If I had the means, you know, the means and the characters, you know, that would be there. You know, there's somebody that it is a studio that is very protective of their intellectual property. So use.
...1976. The American merchant vessel Petrox Explorer has just set sail from the port of Surabaya in search of oil. What they find will shock the world.
We may be sailing into the history books.
They will catch a stowaway.
And landing on the beach of the Skull, where he heard the roar of the greatest beast.
They will rescue a beautiful castaway.
She's alive!
You know, maybe my luck has changed.
And they will discover an uncharted island that is the home of the most incredible creature on the face of the earth. A creature called Kong. Dino De Laurentiis and Paramount Pictures present the most exciting original motion picture event of all time. King Kong. King Kong. A fantastic adventure.
Open the gate!
King Kong, a colossal achievement. King Kong, a motion picture filled with sights and sounds unlike anything you've ever experienced before. King Kong.
Don't flood the tank! She fell in!
With Jeff Bridges, Charles Grodin, and introducing Jessica Lange as the beauty who charmed the beast. And starring the eighth wonder of the world, King Kong. In 1956, he first appeared on motion picture screens across the country. His impact on audiences was instantaneous and unprecedented. His acting technique was revolutionary. His presence, overwhelming. He possessed more raw talent than any performer of his generation. He soon became an international legend, a giant who took the world by storm. Then, suddenly, at the height of his fame, he retired from motion pictures. Now, he is back, and he's more magnificent, more glamorous, more devastating than ever. Prepare yourself. The greatest star of all has returned. Godzilla 1985. Coming soon to a theater near you.
We were talking about King Kong. Just to go back to that guy, Matt and I have covered on this show. We've talked about King Kong 1933, talked about King Kong versus Godzilla, the Peter Jackson King Kong, and the Dino De Laurentiis Kongs, which I know, I'm sure, Tom, you have opinions about.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Those De Laurentiis entries?
You know, I think the... Well, King Kong Lives was unwatchable. I thought King Kong was, it was cool. I like the merchandising of that movie more than anything. I have the viewfinder, the Viewmaster of King Kong. Incredible. You know, I have the Jim Beam bottle of Kong. You know, it's great. I don't... I don't even drink, but I have it. Like, it's great. I think in the book I have the they had a recipe for like King Kong something or other, King Kong orange juice, or I don't remember. I think I have it in the book. But you know, I think if the giant mechanical Kong had worked, the giant mechanical Kong had worked in that movie, I think it would. We'd have a completely different opinion of that film. It was, you know, they. I think it's in that movie for less moving for less than a minute.
Yeah, shot.
You know, you know, him at. I think it's Shea Stadium or whatever it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So it's him at Shea, and that's really it. You know, they really had like just this mechanical Kong that like was supposed to, you know, the way that they pushed it was that it was going to be this groundbreaking special effect, and not even a special effect. It was a practical effect, this groundbreaking practical effect, because they built the whole monster. And, you know, and most of the time it's Rick Baker in a suit, which, you know, again, wasn't great, you know. Maybe it would have been better as a, you know, claymation. It may have been better as, which was somewhat out of vogue at the time, but it could have been done a little bit better that way. Story-wise, I think it was solid, but I think the soupmation at that point was just a little goofy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, if the Mechanicong had... Or the Mechanical Kong, not Mechanicong.
They should have had Mechanicong.
If the Mechanical Kong had worked, I think it would have been a lot better. And I always heard stories about that, about like when they brought the monster to New York, when they brought him to New York and they had him on the street, like people were like ripping out to take souvenirs. They were like rolling Kong's eye down the street.
My biggest takeaway with the King Kong 76 is... I was, I, I like the movie fine, right? But I was really underwhelmed by Skull Island and the lack of monsters. Like, there's nothing there.
That was Skull Island is part of the charm of King Kong. This is something that I like to ask people about King Kong and particularly in those, for fans of the original Kong with Skull Island. Okay, you know where they have, Fay Wray tied up and Kong comes to the jungle and takes her, and then the T-Rex comes and the thing. So do you think that that's every day for Kong? Is that just like a day at the office? Or is this a particularly bad day? Like, oh man, today like a pterodactyl attacked me, or again, is this just another day at the office? This is every single day for Kong. It's like, oh, okay, I gotta kill another dinosaur here.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I kind of got the sense that Kong tried to like lay low, like in his cave lair or whatever, maybe tried to give some distance to the dinosaurs. That was my impression.
Yeah.
But then he couldn't resist Fay Wray's charms,
That's true.
But now I wonder, is it every day that he gets a female sacrifice? Or is Fay Wray just like, actually the way this, like, what's it called? Altar is set up. It seems like the at least the human element is a regular feature.
Well, he does, when he does come to her, he's knocking over trees.
You'd think those trees would be knocked over already.
See, those trees would have been knocked over.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
As you can tell, I've put a lot of thought into this.
I was kind of hoping the sacrifices were maybe like a yearly thing or like every couple months. I hope they're not daily. That is very disturbing if that's the case.
They'd be running out of girls really quick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a good point. Okay. Yeah. Maybe it's like just long enough for the trees to grow back. So it's like once every decade.
Yeah.
And today's the day.
I don't know if she was relieved that she was not the bride of Kong that day, or if she was like, oh man, like I was looking forward to this, or like, oh, man, thank God it's her. Thank God the blonde girl came along.
We don't need these other jokers though. Driscoll and them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Skull Island is the charm. Skull Island is, it's a place of, what is Skull Island? Things like that I think makes it the charm. And the only thing that I like about Son of Kong, which is far inferior movie, the only thing I like about that movie is that Denham, escapes New York. He's all these predators that are saying, hey, you destroyed half of Manhattan, with your monster, you have to pay for it. So he takes a expedition and he goes back to Skull Island, and the tribal chief is like, no, you destroyed our island, you idiot. Like, what, you always might. So he's like, so no matter where he goes, if he goes to the most remote island on Earth or the largest city in America, they're after him. So I think that that's cool. I think that that was a really cool element that they probably should have expanded on a little bit more. But
I do love the fact that it's a direct sequel. Like, it dovetails perfectly with the first film. It's such a campier film. It's goofier. One day we'll talk about it on our show Camp Kaiju, because it's just, talk about camp. It's load. It's all camp.
It's just, well, and I mean, they rushed that out. I mean, it came out the same year as Kong, which is wild. Like, it took them so long to make King Kong, and then it was just, we're just rushing at it. One of the reviews was, it took them, let's say, 46 minutes. Don't quote me on that. For them to get to the monster, for them to get to Son of Kong. And so, again, I was looking at that. I was looking at that review and I was writing it, and I said, how long does it take for them to get to King Kong in King Kong? 46 minutes. So the same amount of time, but just that beginning part was so much better than Son of Kong.
Yeah. And then Peter Jackson took a 90-minute movie and made it 3 hours somehow.
But and also it was some of the most boring parts, like New York without King Kong, New York with Fay Wray.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Yeah. Self-indulgence can be a bad thing. You know, I feel like that. I don't mind the Peter Jackson King Kong, but it's like maybe if producers had been like, you need to give us a 2-hour movie, that might not have been the worst thing, you know?
Yeah.
I saw that one in the theaters.
Yep. Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
I did too. And I think the front row was people who drank for the first time in their lives and all of a sudden went to a monster movie. And it was not an enjoyable experience.
That's too bad. We've all been there, though.
Oh, I was just going to say real quick about the 76 King Kong. I like the cast, Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange, yeah. like relatively early, like right on the cusp of superstardom. It was Jessica Lange's first starring role. So the cast is good.
Yeah, I certainly like the cast. I certainly like the Bollywood behind it. I like anything like that behind a movie. And I think, you know, we haven't really seen something like that in recent memory. Maybe, you know what? Maybe the 98 Godzilla certainly had, you know, something similar where
that was big.
Real big. Yeah.
Talk about merchandise. I still have mine because I was seven. And for a 7-year-old, like Godzilla toys all of a sudden and everything. Of course, it wasn't actually the Godzilla I knew and loved.
Yeah.
But I was taking what I could get, I guess.
Yeah. Even the soundtrack was big.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, the Taco Bell commercials.
Taco Bell commercials. There was everything. I think there may have been a Subway. I think something like that.
Eyes does matter.
Yeah. Yeah, that may have been Subway. Yeah. So yeah, that was everywhere. So yeah, definitely the merchandising opportunity on that film was there, and something we just don't get anymore. You know, I don't think people get that excited for it.
Welcome to Taco Bell. Can I take your order?
Let's see. 1,000 burrito supremes, 700 Mexican pizzas, and one of those new gorditas. Hey, Godzilla, want something to drink?
Godzilla's at Taco Bell on 4 collector cups, and now you can put them in a cool Godzilla cup holder. Get them while supplies last.
From the ocean's unfathomable depths, a gigantic, man-like creature appears. From the fiery depths of the earth comes a prehistoric mastodon of destruction. Before has the screen known such heart-stopping terror. Starring Nick Adams.
Well, I feel he's very important from a scientific point of view.
I'd have to cut off a leg or an arm.
Doctors, I won't let you conduct this test.
Frankenstein, with the strength of 1,000 men. And every man's need for affection that makes him a willing captive.
The chain hurts you.
The new scoop of the century.
King Kong. Mammoth. Behemoth. Goliath. King Kong escapes and meets his greatest foe. The Kong of Steel. A gargantuan duel unmatched by any battle in history. Thundering 60-foot robot Kong of Steel. Creation of the evil Dr. Who. Criminal genius who stops at nothing.
Kong, once again, dig.
King Kong shakes the earth. life against the Doctor Swamp. Thousand thrills as King Kong battles the serpent of Mondo Island.
Look, it's Kong!
Hits himself against the nation's armament. And plunges a beautiful girl into a world of terror. King Kong in a duel to the death.
One of the things that I, you know, kind of back to my book, I guess, is just the ballyhoo and promotional things that they did for King Kong versus Godzilla that were suggested for King Kong versus Godzilla were certainly, you know, interesting parts of the film, of the promotion of that film, like having people dress up like King Kong, you know, having cardboard cutouts of them, playing things on local radio. My favorite was go on television with a zoologist or, you know, something like that, and talk about, are Kongs and Godzillas real? I don't know.
Where's the scientific evidence, you know?
Tom, do you have any more to say about your book, like your process or what you hope? Now that it's out in the world, what do you hope for it?
So, you know, my process of this is, again, I go about it from, you know, kind of this fan perspective. I go about it like, you know, what would I want to read about? You know, what are the things? I also like to find the obscure. I like to find things that people, actually, it was, I think, of my James Bond book. One of the criticisms, I think it was on a Google review or Amazon review or something like that. I think
it was me, actually. I don't know, but go on.
You're the one. It was something like, oh, you know, Tom dives into obscure facts that nobody cares about or something like that. And I was like, well, yeah, that's the point of the book, dude. Like, you know, read a Wikipedia article if you don't want obscure facts, I can give you a brief overview. You know, I could give you a synopsis of the film. I could write that up, but so what? You could read that anywhere.
Mm.
I did give a blow by blow in King Kong versus Godzilla just because I felt it needed to be there. But again, just overall, like I'm not going to give you a synopsis. So this book isn't necessarily a synopsis of the film or anything like that. It dives into the obscure. It dives into the things that I care about, the maybe the forgotten, the weird stuff like that. And that's the stuff that I've looked for my entire life. Those are the people that look for that sort of thing are the people that I'm drawn to. You know, those are my friends. I want to be friends with you. I want to have conversation with you. If you like the obscure or the weird. Speaking of which, and I should make another plug. I should have plugged this earlier.
Plug away.
I'm the executive producer of a documentary, Drew Friedman, Vermeer of the Borscht Belt. It's about the cartoonist Drew Friedman. And it is available now for free on Shout Factory TV. So, and just again, working on that documentary, you know, I found that again, Drew Friedman is known for drawing, you know, the weird and forgotten in Hollywood. So if you're unfamiliar with his work, you know, Shemp, Tor Johnson, and then all the way down to like Elevator Men of America. So just drawing like obscure Sammy Petrillo, who was in Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. Things like that. So in that, while making that documentary with my friend Kevin Daugherty, who's the director and everything else on that picture, you know, I realized that, that, you know, there is this market and people want to know about the obscure. They want to know about the weird parts of Hollywood or whatever else, you know, Tokyo, if you're Godzilla. So that really, you know, sent me down this path of, you know, writing my first two books and writing this one. So yeah, definitely you're going to get a lot of obscure facts. Definitely you're going to get a lot of things in the weeds. Like I when writing in the back of my head, I said, you know what? I don't even want to write about the two ending thing.
Yeah. I'm surprised that hasn't come up yet, but yeah tell us.
Yeah, You know, it's one of these things that, you know, persists. I remember, I wrote about it in the book. I remember renting King Kong versus Godzilla and thinking, oh, I wonder what ending I have. So clearly I'd heard about it. It's like kind of one of those things like everybody heard about, like on the playground, kids talked about it. It's not true. Yeah, there's a little bit of a roar difference. The Japanese, you only get, you get both roars, and American version, you get only the Kong. But clearly in the international sales guide from Toho, they clearly say Kong, you know, that Kong wins, you know, and really, I mean, I do a lot of newspaper digging, you know, looking for articles in newspapers and things like that. I think that's part of my shtick with this. And, you know, just, you know, even articles written fairly recently, you know, it would always be, well, you know, there's two endings. You know, where'd you get this? Dark Horse Comics tried to debunk it in the, I think, 80s or 90s. But it all started with Forrest J. Ackerman of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. He's the one that he claims that he was there on the set while making the film. I don't know if that's true. I did talk to some people that knew him, and they said yes.
Okay,
I say print the legend, not the story. Yeah. So I went with it. I don't know. This is what I'm told. He went to meet with the gentleman who, and I forget his name off the top of my head, but he went on to make Horror World in Japan in the 80s, which was a big horror movie magazine, which would kind of be the, I think, more of like a Fangoria magazine than a Famous Monsters magazine. But he was known as Mr. Horror in Japan. So apparently, Forrest J. Ackerman, who was Mr. Sci-Fi, you know, they met in Japan and they went to the. I don't know. Like
I don't know. That's so fascinating. His
reports in Famous Monster Film Magazine. I have zero idea. I don't have no idea. I'm printing the legend though. He was there, and they, you know, he reported originally on these two endings. It was later reprinted in the Crestwood House books, where again, maybe I assume that that's where every red-blooded American picked up on this between the years of 1970 and 1995 and, you know, and ran with it.
Yeah. You know, maybe Ackerman just overheard Tanaka, producer that he was like, you know, it'd be great if we did this. Yeah. And Honda said, hell no. And then Ackerman just picked up, heard what he wanted to hear.
Yeah. He published it in it was Spaceman magazine. It was a kind of an offshoot of Famous Monsters. It was still done by Warren Publishing, but it was later republished in Famous Monsters, and so that's where it just picked up steam. And I think the Crestwood House books just kind of copied and pasted from.
I love the journalistic integrity of
some. If you can't trust Crestwood House, what can you trust?
Right. The story took on a life of its own, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like so interesting in and of itself.
Yeah. But yeah, but like I said, I a gentleman by the name of Joe Moe, he was intricate. He was a friend of Ackerman, you know, was, you know, one of his, he took care of like the Acker Mansion after Ackerman died. And I had met him a long time ago at Monster Bash convention, and we somewhat stayed in touch, and I've, you know, asked them a couple things here and there. And, you know, when that came up, I thought, well, it's worth a shot. Let's kind of confirm something. But again. You know, he said yes. So I don't know.
All right. Has your research taken you far and wide? Have you traveled to meet these people, or do you just, how do you conduct your interviews? And
so, I mean, I like I said, I like to mostly, well, a lot of my subjects are dead. So
what? I'm out of here.
So that is unfortunate, you know. So, and also I like to look at things from a historical perspective. I think oftentimes, and this happens to everybody, you know, so let's say you're telling a story about something that happened to you 10 years ago. You don't remember that happening. You remember telling the story. And the story probably has changed a little bit. You know, you kind of gave it some editorial license. There were two people there. Now all of a sudden they became one. So I like to look at it from a historical perspective, like what was published at the time. You know, so I like to look at critics from the time. It's easy to look at something from a modern perspective. And I think I learned that particularly with my James Bond book, where, you know, there's a lot of things in James Bond movies you could look at and go, you know, this is a little, you know, these things that he's doing, it's a little weird. I don't know. I wanted to look at it from a perspective of, okay, if I'm watching this movie in 1965, you know, are critics saying, yeah, this is a little creepy? Or are they saying, no, James, you know, this is great. So that's kind of what I often wanted to look at. So I want to look for old interviews. I want to look for old reviews, interviews, source material, things like that. So yeah, certainly Linda Miller was the first interview I actually did for a book. Yeah. Again, it's the end of the text. And I think it adds, because, well, number one, because she was in really four things. You know, she was a model. She was in King Kong Escapes. She was a model, and Rankin said, "Oh, you know, hey, let's get her." And she has some really great stories. She was in The Green Slime, and she was in an episode of My Three Sons. And she was on some other. She was in some show in Japan, where she played a princess or something. So she was in four things. So you're not going to misconstrue anything. You're going to have a pretty good memory of your time making studio films.
Yeah. King Kong Escapes with Ashira Honda and Tsuburaya.
It's like hitting a home run right there.
Yeah, that does it. You had one at bat in your career and you hit a home run. You don't forget that. Yeah.
The only other one that I can think of, you know, that's done better is, what's his name from The Godfather? Can't think of his name. Fredo.
John Cazale.
Yeah. The actor's name? He was in like five movies before he died. He was in Godfather 1, 2, The Conversation, Dog Day Afternoon. The
Deer Hunter.
Old Grand Slam.
Grand Slam out of the park. That's it.
Yep.
So it's him and Linda Miller. So
The Green Slime maybe is more of like a single for Linda Miller. Maybe a bunt, you know?
Hit by a pitch.
Yeah, there we go.
I think that's a great note to end our evening on. Tom, this was absolutely terrific. Thank you for joining us. We'll put links to all your books and your documentary.
Great.
Anything else, just email me. I'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
We'd love to have you back. I'd love to stay in touch. You know, let me know how things are going.
Yeah. I'm working on a book now. I don't have a publisher yet. I may go back to Bear Manor. It's called Monsters Belong on Television. It's actually kind of a takeoff of the King Kong versus Godzilla book. I said something in there like the King Kong airing on WOR television proved that monsters belong on television. And, you know, again, thinking about, you know, becoming a watching those tapes and things like that, you know, and how intricate, you know, television, especially, you know, pre-VHS era, was important to monster movies, you know, drive-in pre-VHS. So it's a look at that. So I'd love to come talk about that. You know, again, we could talk about kaiju films on that.
Heck yeah, but yeah, we talk about all kinds of monster movies. So you talk about monsters on TV. I'm thinking about, it's not Elvira. It's the woman from Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, Vampyra.
Vampira. Yeah. Thank you. So like you say, like from the beginning of television.
Yeah. Yeah. She's square one. Yeah. I'm doing, what's his name? You know, Dana Gould, who did the foreword of my book. He's good friends with Vampira. So I don't know. I have to pick his brain on a couple things, but.
And then we'll pick your brain on how you picked his brain. And then I feel like I had a meeting with Linda Miller just tangentially here.
Yeah. You know, and you know what? And here's the, you know, she's the nicest lady. Like I said, had went and, like, Linda Miller, like Tom Shabilla, like, you know, it's me or my uncle. You know, we're it. Like, that's the only Tom Shabilla on planet Earth. You know, and if you find one of us, you'll find the, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll point you in the other direction. And Linda Miller, I'm sure there's a trillion Linda Millers. And, you know, two of the most popular names, you know, first names and last. And she had no idea that people were looking for, liked that movie or, you know, cared about the movie in any way, shape or form. And, you know, she was an insurance salesman and, you know,
yeah.
Like and, you know, she lived in Virginia and kind of, then all of a sudden, you know, somebody asked her to come to a convention. She was like, oh, what? Are you nuts? Yeah. People care about this. And when I contacted her, you know, I said, you know, I think, you know, she was more than accommodating. She said, oh, yeah, I'll go on Zoom. We'll talk about it. And she sent me pictures. And, you know, I think when we got on, I said, OK, you know, I'll try to make this brief. Like, I'll try to keep this as brief as possible or something like that. And she said something like, oh, no, I like talking about this. I was like,
oh. That's so lovely.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah.
And then she even, you know, there's a drive-in by me that also shows films and things like that. And this summer they had King Kong and Godzilla Fest. And, you know, I was a little upset because it was right before my book came out. So I was like, I don't have anything to sell. So, like, I think the first night they showed King Kong, Godzilla, I forget what the third was. Maybe not Sonic Kong. I don't remember. And then the next night it was King Kong versus Godzilla, Godzilla Escapes, and something else. And she did the intro to the film for it, like, you know, and she was really accommodating and stuff.
Wow.
It was just like, just reach out to her. So
that's wonderful. Keep up the good work, man.
You guys keep up the good fight too. Thank you very much. This is a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, friends, for listening. Remember, you can find Tom Shabilla's links in the show notes. Check out King Kong versus Godzilla, the most colossal conflict the screen has ever known, and his other books on television, spy craze. Tom's got a good catalog going. Well, next time on Camp Kaiju, we will be having Sean Pryor, dear friend of the pod, back on to talk about a 1972 film called Blackula. It is a well-known film, huge legacy for black cinema and beyond, but, you know, are there flaws worth talking about? We're going to do just that next week. In the meantime, go back, check out some of the other black horror films that we mentioned in the beginning of this episode. It is Black History Month, let us not forget, and we hope that you find some really enriching, meaningful, campy work in the rich legacy that is black cinema. And we welcome your thoughts and participation in next week's episode. It has been recorded, so we do know what's a-coming. All right, guys. Please rate and review this show and follow us on patreon.com/campkaiju for additional videos, reviews, merchandise, more. Other ways you can get in touch with us are at campkaiju@gmail.com, campkaijupodcast.com, Instagram, and our voicemail number, 612-470-2612. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, with Mina's Mailbox Music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks, friends. And until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is brought to you by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Whether you're looking for your dream home, a savvy investment property, or expert guidance in home rehab and flipping, the Zach Pack has you covered. Check the link in the show notes for more information.
Look, then run for your life. Incredible is the word for the world's first monster musical. See in magnificent Eastman color the daring, dancing, enticing, and horrifying, the incredibly strange creatures who stopped living and became mixed-up zombies. From the innocence of music and laughter comes the twilight of terror. Along the midway, scantily clad dancers luring the young lovers into the sideshows. See the dancing girls of the carnival murdered by the incredible night creatures of the midway.
I will know that something evil lies ahead for me.
An unspeakable pit of dismal subhuman monsters who drool and gibber, moaning for the thrill of revenge. Incredible are the songs, the gaiety, the zombie stomp of those who will stop living. And then the mix-up, trickery, and the device to ruin. See the hunchback of the midway fight a duel of death with the mixed-up zombies. Turning men into monsters, twisted, tormented human vultures. Yearning to kill. Incredible creatures clutching at the thin thread of their miserable lives. Human vultures. Only the weird zombies remain.
Sure got a shake.
Obey.
Who is the woman branded in birth wearing the wart of horror?
Do as Madame Estrella said.
The world's first monster musical. The incredibly strange creatures who stopped living and became mixed up zombies.